Did you ever think you would make it? I feel I'm so close, I could taste sweet victory. I know this life meant for me. Yeah, why would you bet on Goliath when we got Bet David? Value taming, giving values contagious. This world of entrepreneurs, we gain no value to haters. How they run, homie, look what I become. I'm the one.
Okay, so today's guest, Sam Seder. A lot of you guys were asking to have him on after we had Kyle Kulinski on, Pac-Man on, all these guys on. They said, why don't we get Sam on? Sam runs a show called The Majority Report with Sam Seder. He's got a big YouTube channel, 1.24 million subscribers. We just found out he was a big banker at Goldman Sachs.
Huge.
Hardcore.
Huge.
But he does have a bear. You do have a good story. Maybe you'll share that with the audience. What happened? We'll get into that here in a second.
Sure.
So thanks for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me down here.
So we got a lot of things going on right now. Just yesterday, if you just bought the Wall Street Journal today, this is what the opening story is on the cover of it. Fed boosts rates amid bank turmoil. Powell calls financial sector sound but stresses oversight. The concern becomes whether, you know, they're saying they're going to protect depositors, what everybody's talking about, depositors. Will they protect the banks or not? We don't know. We'll talk about it. Maybe people will have some opinions on it. Sam, if you don't mind, for the audience that doesn't know you, maybe share a little bit about your background.
I've been doing a podcast, YouTube, and I was the first in AM talk radio starting about 18 years ago. Prior to that, I was a writer, comedian, director in showbiz, and sort of stumbled into talk radio on Air America Radio, and grew up in Worcester, Mass. And I like the Red Sox.
How did that happen? How did it happen from going from acting, from comedy, from writing to
it was a total fluke. I mean, as a kid, I was involved in government. Like I had, I did an internship in D.C. and in the Connecticut State House, and I was a government major, and I was involved in municipal politics in Worcester, Mass. When I was in high school, but I also had a dual track of like doing sort of theatery stuff. And when I left, I went to law school for a year, left to do comedy with a buddy of mine. And then about 14 years later, Janine Garofalo, who I was friends with, said she had this opportunity to do political talk radio in the run-up to the 2004 election. And I just thought, I'll do it for 6 months and get back to show business. And I enjoyed it. And during that time, I got married and my wife got pregnant. And so I decided that's where I would stay. I mean, I still did some show business stuff probably as late as 2012. And I'm still a voice on Bob's Burgers, which is a cartoon. But that is just sort of
what are you doing? Bob's Burgers?
I'm Hugo. I'm a couple of characters.
That's cool. Yeah. What's a bigger passion, politics or entertainment? I mean, they can kind of, collide, but what's movies, shows, acting?
Oh, I would say politics are probably more of a passion for me. I mean, you know, I had fun in the entertainment world, and I do have a little bit, like I see with my friends who have all been, not all, but many very successful, and I like their lifestyle, but I find politics more stimulating. And I interview a lot of, like, on my show, policy experts, authors, historians. And so it's like every day I get paid to come in and learn something new. And I like that.
Did you ever have like, I'm going to go into politics, or is it more, you know, doing a show?
There were times where I thought about it. There were times where I thought about it as a kid, maybe.
Not enough money in it. What was the reasoning to say I'm not going to do it? Was it just like, I'm more going to be from the outside than the inside?
No, I think it was, you know, I did a lot of like political stuff in college, and I felt like on some level it was a little bit constraining, but there are times I've contemplated it.
Since you're in politics pretty actively now on the political spectrum, where would you say that you identify? Not the current form of identification with the he, she, we, they, them, like political spectrum. If there was a football field, where do you stand? Like 50-yard line, left, right? Where do you?
I'm definitely of the left, without a doubt.
How far left?
You know, I don't know. I mean, within the context,
are you in the red zone? Are you near the goal line? Are you closer to the 50?
I don't know. I don't really think about it too much in those terms, to be honest with you. I mean, I think that like I think a genuine socialist would say I'm certainly not a socialist. I don't know, you know, but I have no problem with how people identify me in that way. I mean, I'm really more interested in a set of policies and really ultimately just the outcome of what will create the best outcomes for the most amount of people. For me, that's, and you know, there's a couple different ways of saying that, but that's basically what it boils down to me.
As a kid, who was your guy? Like, if you were to say, this is the book that influenced me, this is the guy that I liked the way he spoke, you know, this is the TV guy or the president or the politician, or who was your guy?
I would say I was very moved by the autobiography of Walter Mondale. No, I'm joking.
Mondale.
You're like, fiery,
I mean,
guy.
You like landslides,
like,
Sam?
You know, I was a big, like, I really liked Clint Eastwood movies when I was a kid. I mean, I didn't really realize much about him, the person, but I like those. I like the spaghetti westerns and stuff like that. But
I guess what I'm asking is, you know, more because you said you were in politics in high school, like you were interested in government from earlier on. What was a source of inspiration? Was there somebody you looked up to? Was it kind of like, like if you and I were in high school together in 10th grade, who was Sam?
I think people thought I was a little bit nerdy.
People thought you were a little nerdy?
Yeah.
Did they think you would go into Hollywood and act or no?
I think I got like voted class clown.
Really?
Yeah.
That makes three of us.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I did. Yeah, but I also... you know, I was working for the Worcester Charter Commission at the time, which was starting to like reassess how they were going to apportion votes in the city. And so I don't know. I tend not to have like heroes per se. I don't find that healthy.
Really?
No, I don't think so. I think people get too caught up in the personalities of politicians and really sort of miss what is actually going on.
Heroes as a kid. You didn't have any heroes. You didn't like He-Man. You didn't see, you know, Rocky. Well, Rocky would have been what, 1978?
Yeah, Rocky when I was a kid. Rocky. I was a kid, yeah.
You must have had Larry Bird on your list. Come on.
Larry Bird. I mean,
let's get real here, Sam.
I mean, if we're going to go sports, like Bird, I loved Bird. And I was a fan of McHale and Parrish as well. I got very excited about Russ Francis on the Patriots. And Bobby Orr in hockey. But, you know, I remember, I'm not going to say his name, but I met a guy I was a fan with on the Red Sox in person. And I was like, I wish I had met him. Because in person, I'm just not that impressed. I like what he does on the field. So,
does he kind of look like you?
Who?
The guy you're saying that... Because there's a Mets guy that looks like you.
No, he didn't look like me.
Okay,
at all,
got it. Because I thought you were talking about the. Okay, anyways, no, very cool.
So I met my father that way.
Dad, that's what you hate.
Very cool. So okay, that sounds good. Let's go into the Silicon Valley Bank story. What do you think is going on there? And do you think it's the end of it? Obviously, yesterday Powell came out. A lot of people didn't think if he's going to increase interest rates or not.
Right.
You know, is this guy going to do it? Is he not going to do it? You know, it's not a good time to do it. Maybe take a break for a month or two. You know, we're seeing what happened with Silicon Valley bought a, I don't know, 10-year bond for $100 billion at 1.7%, thinking they're going to make it. And then, bam, they have to sell that for some $20 billion. And you know, the depositors are afraid. Those below a quarter million, which is a small percentage, whatever the number was, 3%, they're covered. But the ones above, everybody's coming and saying, we got to bail the depositors out. What are your thoughts about what's going on with Silicon Valley?
Well, there's a couple of different issues. I mean, and you can sort of go down the line. The biggest issue is that in 2017, the Trump administration, the Republicans, and with some corporate Democrats as well, basically rolled back the regulations that were required for banks like SVB. It used to be if you had $50 billion worth of holdings as a bank, you were subject to the Dodd-Frank requirements about capital to keep the bank safe. And that would have also come along with like sort of subsidiary regulations and regulators being there to make sure that you can't make stupid decisions like that. I mean, they made some very stupid decisions that were that, you know, people involved in banking could take issue with, assuming that interest rates were always going to stay low, whatever. The point of regulations like that, where you take more or less a meat cleaver and you say, is that people can make stupid decisions, but we're going to be here to protect the system and the depositors. The other thing that was going on there with all the depositors had all this other money, this is a kickback situation. There's no doubt about it, right? Because you, you know, anybody with $251,000 cash knows that there is a $250,000 FDIC limit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're putting $500,000 in there or billions of dollars in there, you're getting something from the bank in return, which is low-cost business loans or like 0% mortgages. I'm sure you run into this. You put your money into some big, you know, investment bank, you're getting kickback. You're getting a 0% mortgage. So you go out, buy a $13 million house. You don't have to pay anything for that money. You keep your money in a CD, and you're still, you're making money off of that $13 million house, essentially, that you bought.
Yeah.
Because you've just got that money borrowed cheap. And if they're going to do that, I mean, look, to each their own. If they're going to do that, they need to pay the consequences. They took a risk. I'm going to put my money in an uninsured bank because I'm getting back all this, like, you know, and sometimes I think it was like they did this with their businesses and then they get the personal mortgages, which is also, it's just a kickback. So I say we don't bail those people out because we have the rules and these are the rules. Now, a lot of these people are big names. They have the ability to go on to every show that exists on TV and whatnot and claim that this is going to be a systemic risk. But I don't believe that, frankly. And so, you know, I think what we need to do, and nobody's talking about it, is put the regulations back. We have now proof that it's dangerous to have rolled back the regulations on these mid-sized banks. And so, you know, the deafening silence about it is amazing to me.
So, Sam, let me ask you, based on what you just said. So, you're, so obviously, we know the guys below $250,000, they're covered. But it's a small percentage with Silicon Valley Bank. It's not like it's a big number. The people above $250,000, with these guys that are coming out saying, "Hey, we got to take care of these depositors because if we don't, you know, all these other smaller communities and regionals are going to get hit. These 27 regionals we have, one is gone now; it's 26. They're going to remove their money and they're going to put it in the big banks. This is one of the ways to nationalize it, and we're going to go through only five banks and all this stuff." So the people above the quarter, you're straight up saying, if you had more than $250,000, anything you had, let's not back them up. Let's not protect them. They lost the money.
I think there is that danger that you talk about, that there could be a run on these other banks. I think it's overstated, but I think there is a danger. And I think the way that you deal with that is you come out and you say, we're going to make sure that we're going to subject these 23 other mid-sized banks to the kind of regulation that we impose upon the bigger banks, so that the security you feel with those bigger banks, we're going to provide that security for you by regulating and making sure that they have the capital requirements that they need to protect your money.
Okay, so then go to, if I give you like a cause of a, to say it's this person's fault, let's go through rankings of it, okay? Below $250,000, they obviously didn't do anything, you know, wrong there. The guys above $250,000 in savings. Then you have the people that own shares in the company. They're shareholders of the company. Then you have employees that work for Silicon Valley Bank. Then you have the employees where the companies who banked with Silicon Valley Bank, where the payroll is stuck and they can't pay the payroll. Then you have the politicians coming up with the guidelines, the regulations. If you were to put the blame on those folks and who to take care of, who not to take care of, who would you put at the top? Who would you put at the bottom?
Well, I don't know how to apportion blame amongst those things, but I can tell you this, the but for in that situation is clearly the lack of regulation, right? I mean, I don't know who screwed up in all of those different levels, but I know that if the regulation, if they were subject to those same capital requirements, none of that stuff would have happened in the first place.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of tough to debate that. Because I've been in insurance business for 20-some years, right? You don't see a lot of insurance companies going out of business because insurance companies' capital requirements are a lot higher than banks' requirements. Banks can be a little bit more. We saw what happened in 08 with the whole no income, no assets. Hey, Sam, how much money made last year? $72,000. Sam, one more time. How much money did you make last year? $72,000. Sam, one more time. How much money did you make last year?
Right.
$158,000. Okay, great. Right. How much you have in the bank, Sam? Hey, right. I got $28,000 in the bank. One more time. How much you have in the bank? $380,000. Perfect. No income, right. No assets. Right. And then boom.
The ninja loans.
Ninja loans. Yeah. Right. Everybody takes it. So there's a part of that that I agree with. The whole ninja loan, you know, it was never supposed to be for low and middle income families. The ninja loan, if I recall, came from Australian bank. It was something they were using. And we brought it to the States, and it was supposed to be more for like the, you know, the clients at the Goldman and the higher. And then they said, let's launch this to everybody out there in the streets.
Yeah,
and that's where they took a hit.
You know, you're a bank loan officer, right? Like, I mean, there was a fiduciary responsibility by the person in that scenario there who kept saying, like, you know, put the number up. Because I come in for a mortgage. I don't know. I'm not a financial whiz.
You know who we had here on the podcast 4 months ago? Very uncomfortable podcast. It was with the former CEO of WaMu. I don't know if you remember WaMu, Washington Mutual.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Horrible.
And that thing was a behemoth of a bank, right?
Yeah, $330 billion. I think, as far as I
know. Well, we had Kerry Killinger. By the way, he was kind enough to come in. I didn't know what he thought we were going to talk about. I banked with WaMu for years, and I loved WaMu. I thought it was a phenomenal experience. You'd go there, you know. The customer service, the way you would feel like you're not at a bank. There's not a window where you feel like, hey, you can't shoot us. Everybody was open. There was a relationship thing that was going on. I said, what caused this? You know, why get so reckless about it? Why? What made you think some of these things you were doing with the amount of money that you had were you ended up selling it for Chase? So I guess, I don't know how much you follow the stories. Obviously, you're a guy that's been following every story every day because this is what you do for a living. What have we learned from 08? That we're not repeating today. Maybe even the way Janet Yellen and the Fed is handling the bailout model, they're calling a different thing. What's different about it today than it was in 08, in your eyes?
Well, I mean, the situation is very different, too. I mean, I think, you know, the amount of leverage that we're talking about in the system is just not nearly the same. And a lot, Dodd-Frank eliminated a lot of the more risky stuff. But, you know, again, I can tell you, more importantly, what we didn't learn is when we rolled back those regulations. We could go through that whole thing. We could spend 6 months examining every aspect of what happened there. And we might come up with a different, who was really responsible.
Yeah.
Or there could be shared responsibility. But the bottom line, this is why you need regulation. Just like you said, in the insurance industry, you have a tighter regulation on this stuff. You don't allow for people to come in and play fast and loose with all this stuff, to gamble like they're at the racetrack, and then come for a bailout from us. Because look, the bottom line is, I know it comes from FDIC fees, but who's going to get those fees? The fees that are going to be imposed upon people to bail out guys like David Sachs and all these other right-wing so-called libertarian, they're suddenly libertarians looking for the government handout. But the people who are going to be paying off these fees more than anybody else are lower income people, because they are stickier with banks. They don't have the opportunity to go around. They don't have the time. They don't have the inclination, the savvy to go around and shop around banks where they're going to get lower fees. Maybe they don't have the same amount of deposits in there, so they're not going to be. So that's who's going to get stuck with this bill.
I want to continue with this, but let me go to our sponsors real quick, okay? And this is so interesting with the sponsor. Obviously, with all this stuff that's going on, I've been in the financial industry now for 22, 23 years. And for the longest time, I was very skeptical about alternative investments. I was like, straight stocks, real estate, this is kind of what you look at. And you saw the last few years, more and more people are looking at alternative investments. Masterworks, what it does is it allows you to buy shares in high-end art. Maybe you can't buy a $5 million Banksy or a Picasso painting, but you can buy a share into it. They're allowing folks to do this, like blue chip art, to invest into. I think when you look at the numbers last year, art prices rose on average 29% per Barron's. Everything you do with these guys has gone through the SEC and it's broken into shares. So it's the same exact way you buy stocks as you do through Masterworks. If this is of interest to you and you have a small percentage of your portfolio you want to put and consider into alternative investments, you may want to look into Masterworks. Rob, if we can put the link below. Their website, let me read their website, what we have here, masterworks.art/PBD podcast. One more time, masterworks.art/PBD podcast, but we'll also put the link below for you to join. So let's go back to this on what we can find the fault with. We can say, you know, we need more regulation is what we need. We can say, you know, it's the greedy banker's fault. You know, we can say, hey, why are you being so reckless? You're putting all your money in the bank. You should never put all your money in the bank, right? You got to kind of diversify and put a little bit more money in
different
places.
Well, there's also something called sweeps, and everybody who's involved in a business knows this. I'm sure you know this, that there are third parties out there who will distribute those $250,000. They had that. They had those money there for a reason. And that, I think it was kickbacks. I think it's probably going to come out in a couple of months after more investigation. But again, we don't have to spend our time worrying about who's to blame of those individuals. Maybe they all
are. No, this is where I was going. Oh. How old were you when you bought your first house? Do you remember?
I was, let's see, it was in 98.
Okay, so you got 26
years. I was like 25. Yeah,
perfect. 25. So 25 years old. What was the interest rate when you got in 98? Do you remember?
God, no.
I was an actor.
I had a business manager at the time. I was making a lot of money. I was just okay, like,
so
just
you were living the dream.
Exactly.
But don't worry about the interest rate.
Can you go to 1998 average 30-year mortgage? I don't know. Let's just Google it and see what the number was.
I imagine it was probably around 6.
Probably similar to what it is.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, I'm trying to see what it was. Okay, 6.91.
Yeah, very similar.
There you go. Okay, 6.9. By the way, I think that's where it needs to be for about a decade. I think the number needs to be there. And if you ask me, I think we need to go a little bit more old school in the way we buy stuff, right? Meaning, how much down payment you got? I got this much down payment. Great. You know, and now you may disagree with that and say that's not going to be fair to low and middle income families. But I think there's part of it also, the guidelines to buy stuff has decreased. The guidelines to lend out money has decreased. You know, money became so cheap for such a long time where people were going out to getting money left and right. What are your thoughts on
that?
Well,
I know on mortgages, no, it's a lot stricter than it was, let's say, 15, 20 years ago. I mean, it's much harder. You need to provide much more documentation, and the loan companies are far more stricter. I mean, they're not quite where they were in the wake of the financial crisis, but they're still pretty tight. I mean, the problem I have with the raising of the interest rates is basically what Jerome Powell says every time he does it, which is we need to get more people unemployed. And that's, I mean, and look, we can argue as to whether the Fed has the tools it needs to fight inflation in this instance. I don't even know if I agree so much or just like the Fed itself says that the inflation that we went through, only about 30% of it was a function of demand, right? The other, a significant portion of it was a function of logistics and like mismatch products and this and that with because of COVID, right? It wasn't a question that we didn't have the productivity or the capacity to meet demand. It was just that it was mismatched for a long time. You're sending shipping containers to places you had never sent it before. To get them back is a lot more expensive. These things are starting to work through the system. Wages contribute a little bit because there has been some wage growth for the first time in decades, essentially. A lot of it is also maybe the plurality of it. This is based upon the Fed numbers, is basically just the corporations seeing the opportunity to raise these rates. And so the Fed comes in, they have one tool to deal with inflation, and that is, you know, they're a hammer. Except for I'm arguing that it's not a nail that they're hitting, it's a screw. And they're doing this, in my estimation, as a way of weakening labor. They are going to kick a million people.
How would you do it?
How would I do it? Well, I would deal with it fiscally, or I would just wait. I would wait because you're starting to see the trends all move in the right direction in terms of inflation. And I would wait. I would have probably done maybe half of what they've done. Maybe.
So 2.5, whatever the number is.
Yeah.
You mean the most recent?
No. He's saying
today,
like the whole whatever's happened.
I mean, look at it today, right? Like they're worried about the banks. At the same time, they're like desperate to like, we need to kick a million, 2 million, 3 million people out of work. I mean, they're explicitly saying this. And so, That does not make sense to me.
Sam, a guy here, Scott Rodriguez, just said, sorry, but 80% of loans given the last 3 years only required 5% down payment. It was much harder to get a loan in the 90s.
In terms of mortgages?
Yeah.
It's conceivable that it was harder to get a loan in the 90s. I'm comparing it to like the aughts. But I can tell you, I mean, like I have very close.
Do you think do you think it's a better guideline to put a minimum 25% for anybody to buy a loan, or no, 5% down payment is fine?
I mean, I think I don't know if the number's 10% or 20%. I'd have to like read into see, you know, where we're talking about foreclosures, but we're not having a foreclosure problem right now.
Not yet.
Because if he keeps raising the interest rates and decreasing the value of homes, at this type of rapidity, you know, rapid rate, we might. Right. But, you know, the way you avoid that is don't do that.
So let me read this about what happened. This is an insider story. The Fed may provide as much as a $2 trillion in liquidity relief for banks after Silicon Valley collapse, JP Morgan says. Chase estimates that the Federal Reserve may need to inject $2 trillion into the U.S. banking system after the collapse of three lenders last week. This would help prevent a run on deposits and address the scarcity issue in the U.S. banking caused by the U.S. Fed monetary policy. The Fed's Bank Term Funding Program, the BTFP, is an emergency loan mechanism that will allow banks to obtain liquidity by putting up their bond holdings as collateral. The Fed will accept the bonds at face value instead of their current market value. Has not been qualified by the Fed yet, but it is expected to be significant enough to cover all uninsured deposits. In the U.S., JP Morgan estimates that this is going to be around $7 trillion. But suggest that the five largest banks are unlikely to use the program, which would bring the actual amount the Fed provides to closer to $2 trillion. Does this sound like a bailout to you?
Yeah, of course it does. Why are those big five banks not taking the money? Because they have been subjected to the Dodd-Frank regulations, and they haven't been able to get themselves in this type of situation. So to be clear, the Fed's raising rates this fast explicitly to make more people unemployed in this country. Explicitly to do that. That's explicitly their goal.
Well, their goal is to reduce inflation. That's their first goal.
No,
a byproduct.
Look, it's not a byproduct any more than me like taking my hammer, slamming it on your hand, and saying,
both of you are right, but Powell, when he was asked, if you remember to hear him, when he was asked, he says, you realize, and I think it was Kennedy that asked him, Senator Kennedy, that said, hey, you realize what you're doing is, to fix the economy, you have to lower the unemployment. And then what did he say? Powell said, that could be a cause of it, but that's not why we're doing it. He says, no, that's why you're doing it. And I know you're not a Kennedy guy because he's a Republican side, but he's like, no, that's exactly what you're doing.
Well, everybody knows it. I mean, it doesn't matter, Republican, Democrat. Anybody who's honest knows exactly that's what the plan is.
But do you really think that's the plan? Do you really think the plan?
That's explicitly the plan. I think he said today, by the end of 2023, we need to have 1 million people out of work. I mean,
why would they do that if they know it's going to hurt the economy?
Because they have one tool to deal with inflation, and that is to raise interest rates as a way of cooling the economy. And frankly, I mean, this is the charitable view. I'm articulating the charitable view. And to cool the economy means, as a byproduct, that you're going to kick people out of work. In my estimation, this is the first time we've seen any type of wage growth in decades, right? The wages versus productivity has been out of sync for decades. And I think, frankly, people don't want labor to have any power. You're seeing increased unionization. You're seeing increased work action. You're seeing people saying, like, you know, I don't want to work in this. Yes,
You think Powell's playing politics in increasing interest rates?
This is not politics.
But it is, though. Union is a form of your policies. Powell is one of the most powerful men in the world today. You know that. I know that, right? So when he moves he's controlling one of the most important knobs, right, which is the rates.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. So, but I'm trying to think myself. Like, I'm trying to sit there and say, okay, you know, when they gave $1.7 trillion in, relief, hey, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, or during COVID, hey, we're going to give $2.1 trillion, we're going to send people this much of money, this, that. Hey, are they trying to get people not to work, right? That's what they're trying to do. Are they really, or were they doing it because they're like, dude, I'm not letting you work from home, so I have to send some money to you if you're getting unemployed, and I just laid off how many people at the restaurant restaurants were crushed by COVID. Well, I got to kind of take care of you. But then what happened with the money? The money went into the rich because, you know, the low income, middle income doesn't know how to save money. And they spend the money. They're trying to make ends meet. So sometimes you think from the policies and you say, oh, they're trying to do something really bad. You think Powell has negative intentions or
I don't think any of this. I have a different perspective on how all this works. I don't think that Powell is sitting there going like it's going to negative. I just don't think that these people care. I mean, look, we attacked Iraq, right? Mm-hmm. 20-year anniversary mm-hmm. yesterday or 2 days ago. By anybody's estimates, we killed hundreds, if not hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. Why?
At this point, this story, we both aren't the same page on. We know why.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But how is it that that decision was made? They don't care about that human loss. And I don't think Powell, at the end of the day, really cares enough about the immiseration of millions of people. He thinks the most important thing for the stability of society is to save the bankers.
Sam, do you think...
I just disagree.
Sam, do you think it was healthy for us to go on a 128-month economic expansion only to be disrupted by COVID? It would have continued into 100... You think it was healthy to have interest rates as low as we did for over 10 years?
I mean, I think there's an argument that you could have crept them up, slowly, you know, up a couple of percentage points.
But
I was also told, listen, in the aughts, when I started this job...
You know, you sound like a capitalist if you defend that.
I don't care what I sound like. I mean, when during the aughts, I was told that the lowest rate of unemployment we can have in this country is 6%. If we have it lower than that, then the whole thing falls apart.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Of course.
We were told that was the absolute, like nature only allows that. And then all of a sudden that we can have more unemployment. I mean, less unemployment. We can have 3%. I mean, we are presented by, these powers, ideas that happen that basically they're in a closed loop with just other people who have power and money and have decided that this is just sort of the natural state of being. And it's not. I just disagree with that premise.
Okay, but let me go back to this. It's very important. I want to make this point. I want to ask you this. 128-month expansion, is it fair to say during that period when rates were as low as they were, they benefited capitalists? They benefited, someone's phone is, if you guys put such a phone as that from the mic, yeah. You know, it's typically Verizon. Whoever's Verizon, AT&T doesn't do it, it's only Verizon. But, you know, it's
I get
that benefited the capitalist because money was cheaper, right? So to argue your argument saying, well, a true socialist would say, I'm not a socialist, but I'm on the left. You're not for, you know, making it that easy for those guys, right? So money was so freaking cheap for so long that we have to pay a price for it. And now you're looking at the economy. It looked like everything was good, but a big part of it was fake, Sam. We had a lot of fake success the last few years.
Well, I mean, look, I'm just measuring on, again, the way I view things is what's going to make things better for the most amount of people. And in terms of like, you know, it being in favor of the capitalists, I would also change our tax policy. So, I mean, I would claw some of that back, quite a bit of it back.
What would you do?
I would return to the tax policy when we had the greatest, sort of the widest economic expansion shared by more people as a percentage of our population than any other time in this country, which was in the 50s and the 60s. And I would return to the tax rates more or less there. So your top tax rate at that time was 90%. Top marginal rate for every dollar over $470,000 you would earn. So that would be equivalent to around $3 million today. I think we should return to that type of tax.
You want it to go as high as 90% at the top marginal tax
rate? At the top marginal tax rate. So understand, like, that only kicks in with every dollar above 3 million.
I hear you. And yeah, I mean, that's the famous Reagan situation where I think it was over anything over $200,000 at that point. This might have been in the 40s, that he would only do two movies a year because he'd get paid $100,000 per movie, and then he wouldn't even do a third movie because he would only get 10% of the revenue because he, and he's like, fuck it, I'm not doing another movie.
Yeah.
So wouldn't Reagan, that curb growth,
Reagan,
wouldn't that
when
curb,
Reagan started telling that story, yep. You know who he was working for when he started telling that story, right? He was going around, I think it was for working for GE, trying to convince people not to get Medicare for All. I mean, if Reagan could have gotten three movies or five movies, he would have done it. He was working with chimps. He would have been happy to do that for his career. Believe me.
So
believe me.
You, what's the top marginal tax rate right now? 39%? What is it?
I think
right
it's 37, 39%.
So you're in favor.
I will say this, though, just to finish up that Reagan story. I will say this to you. I remember being in L.A., and taxes, top line had hit whatever the all-in was, 57 and a half. I don't know what the number was, around 57 and a half. You live in Brooklyn. So 57.5%, people are like, what the hell is going on here? There was this girl who was a top realtor in the San Fernando Valley area, one of the top realtors. Her picture was on all the benches. Everywhere you would go, you would see her. And she was one of the realtors making very good money. She's making $500,000 a year income, doing good for herself, whatever the number was, $400,000, $500,000. One day, I stopped seeing her pictures on the seats, and I'm at Wood Ranch with my wife, and I said, hey, are you, you're the girl, right? She says, yeah, I am. She's with her husband and her two kids. I said, what happened? We haven't seen you lately. She says, it's so funny you ask. My husband and I made a decision that the moment taxes got so high, it was more important for me to be stay home. It wasn't worth me working to pay this much in taxes. So there's a part of what he's saying. Yeah, whatever, whether he's going to do the movies with chimps and all
I guess,
but there's a part of it that kind of incentive needs to be there.
America would not have suffered by the lack of Ronald Reagan movies. And I would also argue that, like, I bet you, I guarantee you, there was no less houses that sold because that one particular broker stopped selling houses at a certain point.
So go to it. So right now,
I don't think that's a problem. I really don't. I mean, I think
to raise it to 90%.
Yeah, no, I think
top line,
you know, what you're talking
plus.
About is sort of the Laffer curve, actually, right?
Yeah.
You know, the
you
Laffer
love the Arthur Laffer curve. You're a big fan of it, apparently.
I'll tell you what I love about the Laffer curve is that we had a perfect example of a perfect model of what happens with the Laffer curve. Right? Like the Laffer curve argues that the higher the tax rate goes, the less inclined people are going to be to generate income. And then because they're generating less money, there's going to be less tax receipts collected by the government. Art Laffer was Sam Brownback's number one advisor in Kansas. Do you remember this when Brownback became governor? He basically gave over his entire tax structure to Art Laffer. They had it destroyed the tax base in Kansas. It ended up destroying their entire education system. They had an amazing Kansas university. Brownback gets plucked out of Kansas and literally sent to be ambassador to Ether. You know what? They made him ambassador to faith because they didn't want this guy around at all. The Republican-controlled Kansas legislature raised taxes back up because it had destroyed their tax receipts. The theory may sound good, but it doesn't work in practice.
So are you on YouTube and Rumble or just YouTube?
I'm on YouTube. I think we put it on Rumble. I think we're on Twitch. And
all over the place. Okay, so let me ask you this question. If YouTube took their AdSense from 55 to 15, would you continue creating content?
Yeah.
You sure?
Sure.
You'd continue creating content?
I wasn't doing YouTube for a long time.
How do you make a living today?
I have membership. I have membership that people pay. I get ad revenue from different places.
Okay, so let's just say the membership that you get from Patreon or whoever it is, okay? What if their fees went from them keeping 5% to 60% to 90%? Would you continue creating content?
I mean, I would probably have to cut back if there was that.
Exactly.
Well, but that's only because it's such a big change.
No, because that's the part about incentive, Sam. So your audience gets you.
I'm not saying we'll cut the revenue for these businesses. I'm saying that the amount of
money. You have no choice, though, because you're paying these guys. You need the revenue.
No. I'm not suggesting we cut revenue for businesses. What I am suggesting is after that revenue comes in and we divvy up and I have my net profits, then my taxes would go up. But I will say this, like if, let's say, the taxes went up on me personally, would I stop going on YouTube? No.
So would you be able to scale it at the, how many employees you got working for you right now?
I'm not talking about cutting revenue,
I get that. How many employees are you working working for you right now?
We have payroll, I think, like six or seven.
Okay, you got six or, that's a small business you got there, right?
Sure.
Six or seven people, okay. If all of a sudden AdSense went up, the fees for your Patreon, I don't want to offend you when I say Patreon, I don't know who you use. Whoever you use that's got your membership stuff that you got.
We use Fans FM.
Okay, there you go. That's a shout out to them. So Fans FM? Right, Fans FM?
Fans.fm. It's actually Fans.fm. A great service.
Okay, fantastic. So if they raised
it. Less than Patreon.
If they take 50%, all of a sudden, and they say YouTube says AdSense goes to 15%, would you be able to employ those six people?
No, if my well, I don't know, but probably
maybe that's because you're rich.
Probably not. But I'm not suggesting that we cut revenue for businesses. I'm suggesting that what is left over from revenue, if it's over $3 million, that goes into the pocket of the owner of this enterprise, that $301 gets taxed at 90 cents.
Let's have fun with this. So here's a question for you. And I kind of know what your answer is.
And I want to be clear on something.
Yeah.
I'm doing this. I subscribe to this not because I think that we need the money or that this is going to, you know, be a panacea in terms of like how we would spend this money.
Yeah.
But I see in this country a massive problem with wealth inequality and the commensurate political inequality that comes with it. We have wealth inequality in this country like we've never had before.
I don't disagree. So there's not a disagreement there. But the solution is where we're going to disagree. So let's kind of process that together. Okay. So you know the whole thing, like I remember when I first got out of the military and I went into the financial industry, it's 1999. I know nothing. It's 2000. I know nothing about it. The speaker gets up. Well, have you been noticing that the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poor? I'm like, okay, my dad's at a cashier at a 99-cent store 15 years. My parents got divorced twice.
I hope you said to that guy, you ain't seen nothing yet. Yeah. Wait to 20
years
from now.
But you're right,
it's
though.
Be completely out
but,
of control.
But you're right, though. But why is the question? So here's a question for you. So you're saying above $3 million, you know, that money that the owner's going to keep, we got to tax them 90%. Fine. Okay. So you believe the money, like when I was in the military, you would buy a product for the Humvees and they would say, yeah, you know, we pay $600 for this piece. We're like, dude, this piece is $40.
Right.
Why the hell are we paying $600 for? Well, you know, the contracts, you know how they are, man. The government always pays a lot because they're dumb. They always pay more than it's usually worth. A $40 piece for a Hummer, they're paying $600. I'm like, that's an awesome business for the other guy.
Yeah, we have horrible oversight in the military.
But this is the point, though. This is the point. And I want to actually sincerely get your thoughts on this, on how we address this. So if somebody overpays for a product, that person's either got to be fired or they're an overspender or a terrible negotiator. But it's one of the three, right? Okay, so you feel money going to the government, we do more good with, or money staying in the free market for people to produce more value? Where do you feel values produce more?
Well, I'm not, I mean, I'm not sure I fully get what you're saying, but let me put it in this way.
It's a very serious, simple
okay.
question.
Well, let me make it a little bit more concrete.
Yeah.
So you guys know that the biggest part of the budget, more or less, is Social Security and Medicare, right?
And Medicaid,
And Medicaid.
Entitlement programs.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can call them entitlement programs.
They are.
I call them social insurance. Programs
because tomato, tomato.
That's what they really are.
That's 90% of the budget. I want to say
no. The military is about $850 billion. Social Security is like $1.7 trillion. I think Medicare is probably close to like $700 billion.
It's about 60%.
And then there's other. Yeah, so, but
way more.
It's a high number. It's a big number. You're right. It's
a
high number.
You'll find that it's. I think our annual budget is somewhere around like $2.7 trillion, and the military is like $800 billion, $900 billion. You know, that you can see anyways, that they show us.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, Social Security, Medicare, the two biggest things that the government does are wildly popular. Medicare, you come from the insurance business. You probably know this. To administer health insurance, there's like 13, 15% cost in the administration of that health insurance. For Medicare, 3%. Far more efficient. Far more efficient. And co-pays are less. I mean, and the whatever you want to call it, consumer satisfaction. I don't like to think of citizens as consumers, but the satisfaction's huge, through the roof, particularly when people use it. It's people appreciate it who don't use it. You know, if I got my parents, they're on Medicare, I'm pretty psyched about it because I don't have to take care of them. My mother's in a nursing home now. It's Medicaid that's doing that. I'm not responsible for that cost. Social Security, through the roof. In fact, I think even Republicans, I think even a majority of Republicans want to expand.
But popular is not a way to qualify something. If I went to high school and I said, guys, I'm giving dime bags to everybody weed, I'd be a very popular kind of high school. So well, that is a wrong way to qualify.
You said efficiency.
Yeah.
Medicare, 3% right. Administrative costs versus 15%.
That's like the kid that's running for class president who's like, every Friday we're throwing a pizza party. Well, he's going to get everybody's vote. But who's paying for the pizza party?
Well, workers. In fact, I would argue that we should be actually removing the cap on Social Security taxes. Because right now, you know, it goes only up to $160,000, right? There's a cap. Traditionally, Social Security has captured or touched 91% of the country's income. You follow me? And now it's somewhere down in like the mid-80s because of wealth inequality.
But your argument on the flip side of it, the argument can be as well to say, well, at the beginning when they came out with Social Security, there was only a few thousand people in America that was actually using it. It was not meant to be for as big of a behemoth of what
kidding?
It is today.
No, that's
it
kept true. Two-thirds of our elderly out of poverty. It keeps two-thirds of our elderly out of poverty.
Nobody's arguing the benefits of Social Security.
That's not the argument, though. That's not the argument. The argument is, originally, when it came out, it wasn't for the bigger percentage.
You had to wait. You had to wait until you build up funds.
No, you didn't have to. You had to have capitalist work and overtax them to be able to fund it. That's what you had to do. But let me go back to the question.
I think what you are saying, just to validate your point, I think at that point, this is FDR back in the day.
Yeah, we can pull up the data.
I think there was 40 workers for every retiree. I think now it's closer to like 3 workers.
Yeah, it's not sustainable.
But it's not even close.
No, it is sustainable.
You think it's sustainable.
I don't think it's sustainable. I'm looking at the Social Security Trust Fund actuarial
table. When they sent you in the Social Security letter, they're telling you if we go this way, this is going to go bankrupt.
No, you're misreading it. The trust fund is going to go bankrupt. In 1981, Greenspan and Reagan expanded the trust fund. We had a surge of baby boomers. There is a trust fund that exists that is essentially like a rainy day fund. That is going to be insolvent around 2033.
2033. 10 years. You are correct. I just had this conversation this past week.
However,
that's not a concern. That's not a concern.
It is a concern. It will cause 20% in cuts to our benefits.
Okay.
But that's it. Period. Now, the way that we can get rid of that 20% in cuts in this Social Security Trust Fund is to do what I'm suggesting. Remove the cap so that every dollar you make, even above $160,000, is taxed by Social Security.
Sam,
and then your kids will be long dead before that trust fund is out.
Hopefully, if I raise my kids right, my kids won't need to be supported by the government.
If they don't need that social insurance, look, I mean, how can you, as an insurance guy, how can you not understand this?
I don't
sit around saying like, you know, I hope that I don't need my fire insurance. I hope I don't. If your kids don't need Social Security, old age insurance,
we
will tax the money back.
I am better for society if I find ways to get people off of needing any of this stuff than to rely on it more and more and more, because I'm truly hurting those who are creating commerce. That's who I'm hurting. But let me go back to my
question.
Hold on
for one second.
Let me ask a question.
401ks.
You still haven't answered my question for me. No, wait.
401ks with a private solution.
You still haven't answered my question. Let me go back to the question to you. So my question at the beginning, you have not yet answered. Okay. When you said, you know, I would go back to the old tax system and I would take you to the 50s and 60s where we had a 90% Okay. And I asked you a question. I said, who do you think produces more value? I gave the example of the Humvee, the pieces in the Army, how much we were paying, $600, but the piece was only $40. And the government tends to overspend because they're reckless spending. They don't really, they're not really held accountable. Does money going in free market create more value, or money going to the government create more value for people?
Explain to me what you mean by value.
Okay, so value to me is, you know, if I can give money to free market and lower taxes where they can go create more jobs, more opportunities, is that better for us long term, or is it better for us to raise taxes, to take away incentives and give that money, tax money, goes to politicians to make decisions what to do with the money? Are politicians better at making decisions on what to do with our money, or are we?
In a broad way, I would say if we're going to look at the biggest chunk of money in the government to make this assessment, right? $1.7 trillion, Social Security. And we can compare it to the one sort of like comparable thing in the private sector, and that's a 401k. I would have to say, I mean, just based upon the way you've set up this question, that obviously the government, because Social Security has been the single most effective program that we have in this country. It has kept 2/3 of our senior citizens out of poverty as a social insurance program. 401ks have been a disaster. They've been a disaster. Just Google right there in front of you, the 401k experiment. People took the money out. I mean, and grant you, like, you know, you can make an assessment that these individuals were stupid or immoral or whatever it is. I'm looking at the goal of keeping senior citizens out of poverty. The government has been able to do that far more effectively. 2/3 of our seniors are in nursing homes because the government is paying for it. You can look around at anything that doesn't involve a profit motive. Like, for instance, the post office. If we didn't have a government-run post office, do you think you could live in, you know, the most rural parts of the country and get postal service for 42 cents or 48 cents you can send a letter? No way. What person looking to make a profit would do that? In fact, I've got a great example. This is, you know, I was doing radio during Katrina. And there was a story that haunted me for years and years. The when Bill Clinton, I'm not a huge fan of Bill Clinton's administration, frankly, but one of the things he did do well was to build up FEMA. I guess having come from Arkansas, he had a pretty good sense of what was important there. And Bush, when he came in very early on, privatized a ton of it. There was a story, it was a very small story, in New Orleans. The buses that was supposed to come to New Orleans to evacuate people before Katrina hit. There was a whole ton of buses that went through three different contractors, right? There was like a general contractor and then a subcontractor and then the subcontractor was going to bring the buses. They were from like 3 or 4 hours away. And maybe it was 6 hours. I can't remember the exact details. They were going to send the buses, but the guy whose job it was, who owns the bus company, and then the contractor above that, they waited longer because if you send the buses and they're not used, they're going to eat that cost, right? It's going to cut into their profits. They didn't send the buses. They didn't get there in time. People couldn't get evacuated. Would it have changed the trajectory of the thing? I doubt it, but it would have saved some people. And the point is that there are some jobs that the government does better because the value there is not measured in terms of actual sheer dollars. It is measured in, you know, essentially, how much immiseration are you inhibiting people from suffering? And so, yes, I agree that when it comes to auditing in the military, the worst government agency we have, because it's very easy, very hard to sort of like scrutinize the military. People don't like that. And it's also a huge power base of a lot of money. They make a ton of money out of this. I agree with that.
But same with insurance.
But if you look at Medicare, Social Security, the numbers don't lie. 3% administrative costs for Medicare.
I appreciate some of the points you're making. I do think that you're kind of conflating a couple different things. I think to Pat's question, whether the government is better at spending your money or whether the private markets or private companies are better It's not even close. If private companies ran
by spending money, like to buy like soda or to actually like just direct it in a way that keeps less people from suffering.
Okay, we have $31 trillion in debt right now. I think that's evidence enough, Sam, that we're not so good at spending money here in America.
It sounds like politicians, we're really good at spending money.
Well, we're not good at
managing money. It's a better word, yeah.
Okay, there's a difference between being frugal and being smart with your money and just being wasteful. The government is clearly fucking wasteful. Where you are correct is that most retirees and most Americans do appreciate Social Security, do appreciate the entitlement programs that come with this country, whether it's Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, no doubt. But that doesn't mean the government is good at spending money. We're seeing that Social Security is about to go bankrupt.
The trust fund is going to be insolvent
by 2023. And yes, I just had this conversation literally 2 days ago in D.C. where he kept using the word bankrupt. I said, what does that mean?
Who kept using that word?
Which Republican used it? It wasn't even a Republican. He was sort of a Social Security financial advisor expertise type of guy. But I said, what do you keep saying bankrupt? Is that meaning that retirees will not be receiving benefits? He goes, no, they'll probably be slashed by 25%, you use 20. So we can, you know, cut the baby in half here. But how familiar are you with the three-legged stool of retirement?
Of course, yes.
Okay, so it used to be you had three avenues to retire. You had pensions, which pays, do they even exist anymore for
they
90%
of
people?
They exist more as a defined contribution than defined.
They're not
benefit.
Very popular these days. I don't know how many people here have pensions. You have Social Security, which was never meant to be a retirement program. It was an insurance policy if you live too long, which basically Americans are now. Or you have your personal savings, which is the 401k. We can argue the merits of 401ks and Roth IRAs, what have you. But Social Security should not be keeping Americans afloat for 30 years of their life.
Well, that's a failure of the private industry, isn't it?
Why is it a failure of the private industry?
Well, I mean, Social Security is maintained. The idea that we're leaning on the government stool because the other two have failed, that's a function of private industry.
Isn't that a function of just the average person understanding how money works and saving money, investing and doing it properly?
Versus the government or institutions? 60% of the country lives paycheck to paycheck. How are they supposed to save this money?
Well, how are they spending their money, I guess, is the biggest question. How many people have credit card debt? How many people? You just said when you took out a mortgage, you said, I'm an actor. What was the rate? You're like, I don't fucking even know. You should know.
Well, I was making so much money that
I don't give a shit how much money you're making, Sam. You should know what your mortgage rate is.
But, you know, I mean, I didn't remember what it was in 1998, but I mean, I know what it is now. But I mean, but I was making so much money, but I was making, I was in the top. I don't know if I was in the top 1% at that time, but probably pretty close.
So let me ask you a question.
And I was a single guy who had just gone from making, you know, $22,000 a year to all of a sudden making that
how much
in
were you
less
making
than a week.
At that point?
I mean, I was making a lot of money.
Now, how comfortable at that point would you have been paying 90% in taxes?
Sure.
So you actually want to pay 90% in taxes?
No. Let's be clear.
That?
I think it should be 90% for the every dollar you make over $3 million.
Yeah.
That would not have impacted me at that time. So but I would have been happy to pay more taxes.
But why would anyone want to
You know why I'm laughing? Because it's always let's tax the people a little richer than me. It's always let's tax
the
guys that are.
Well, it was a lot richer. But I'm just going back.
If you're saying 22 a week, you were making $1 million in 98. That's a lot of money.
No. Well, it wasn't 20.
You said 22 a week. That's $1 million a year.
No. That was the year before. I mean,
But you're making money. Let's just.
I was making a bunch of money. So I'm just going back to when we had the Great Compression, which was when we had the least wealth inequality in this country. Mm-hmm. We had the same. The GDP was, you know, consistent with where, you know, on our trajectory, but it was spread out. It wasn't like this. Essentially, it was more spread out. It's called the Great Compression. And I'm just using that figure. I mean, look, if it's going to be 85% over 3 million or 85% over 4 million, I'm just basing it on what was the most successful economic of this country.
Why not do 90% over $250,000?
I mean, if the numbers bear it out, I'm agnostic as that. Again, I'm just pegging it on when we had the most success in this country in terms of our economy.
I appreciate that you're pointing out the success, but right now the top marginal tax rate federally is 37, 39. Okay, you do realize how shocking it is to say, all right, rather than go from 37 to 39, yeah, how about 40? How about 50?
How many
you want to go to 90?
How many people do you assume? How many people do you assume would be touched by that tax? Would be implicated?
Top 1%.
Look
at this number right here. Share of total income taxes paid.
Less.
The top 1% in this country pay 42.3%. The bottom 50% only pay 2.3%. So 150 million people are paying nothing in taxes.
Right.
And you want to keep the 1% paying more and more.
I think it's actually even less than 1%, to be honest with you. I think we're talking about 0.05%.
Sure, but let's tax them even more.
Oh, I specifically want to make it illegal to be almost as wealthy as you. Not quite, but a little bit more. Like, I want to make it not illegal. You're not going to go to jail.
So nobody can be billionaires. No billionaires in America.
Absolutely.
Sam,
100%.
Why? Don't you want America to be known for greatness, for innovation, for capitalism, for all the amazing things that we've done in this country?
My definition of
greatness. You want to go to, like, Nordic socialism.
My definition of greatness is different from yours.